Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. I want to remind you that our goal is to bring you credible and valid information and insights from diverse members of our community. Central Coast Voices addresses how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community and how we look at the long-term ramifications of changes in our society. It's a project of Action for Healthy Communities, and that's part of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. You can see the entire report that is put out every 3 years by Action for Healthy Communities called Vital Signs, Understanding San Luis Obispo County. You can find that report at actionslo.org, and we can give you some other insights into that. And you can download that report or take a look at it. Online, there is no charge for that, and it's a great source of information about what's going on in San Luis Obispo County and trends and such. We will be putting together a new report for December of 2016, so you may be contacted about a survey in the very near future for that particular report. And if you can help out with that, that's great to have. We're going to talk about a topic that I kind of put in the category of everyone knows something about this, and an awful lot of people don't know as much as they should know about it, and it's maybe for a lot of people misunderstood. We're going to talk about living with MS. That's multiple sclerosis. It's an autoimmune disease, and it causes an abnormal response to the body's immune system, and it attacks the central nervous system. We can go into some real details with that, obviously, during the hour. I want to also remind you this is a call-in program. The phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. This is Public Radio KCBX. This is the community that we're part of, and we want you to be part of the discussion, too. In studio, I have April Nordyke, and she is a participant in the Multiple Sclerosis Society's walk that's coming up later this month, but she is also a woman living with MS now. So she is someone indeed who has MS. On the phone with us is Fotini Alvarez, and she is the director of the Central California chapter of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. Due to some conflicts with her schedule, she needs to be with us on the phone today. And I'm glad they're both with us. Want to double check. Fortini, are you there today? You there?
I am here.
Okay,
I
wanted to make sure you could hear me and I could hear you, and April's in studio. There's all kinds of stuff to talk about this, and I guess I'm gonna start with April, because it's probably in the category of things that people are gonna ask about, and they're gonna scratch their head and they're afraid to ask you about it. How long have you had MS, and how has it manifested for you in your life?
Well, I was diagnosed about 4 or 5 years ago, and I don't know exactly how long I've had it, because I had symptoms coming up before it. The diagnosis for MS is kind of complicated. It's more a diagnosis of exclusion, so they test you for a lot of other things before, and there's a system that they use to actually diagnose you. So you have to, like, have had a MS attack within a certain amount of time from your last MS attack. I had a spinal tap. So they found proteins in my spinal fluid that, along with the MRI that showed lesions on my brain. So that filled the criteria. So getting diagnosed is the first step.
There's, this is a tough conversation to talk about sometimes, because I've known people, and I've know people with MS. One is someone who I believe has had MS for 12 or 14 years. And, unless you were to talk to her and she would explain to you that she has MS, it would never be anything anybody would notice. The flip side of that is I know someone or knew someone who's no longer alive, who developed MS and frankly did not survive a year to a year and a half after she was diagnosed, which was startling, because I think for a layman's perspective, our understanding is that people get MS and it actually progresses, but it progresses very slowly over a very long period of time. So some people have it, and it affects them differently. No case is the same.
No, it does affect everybody differently, as everyone is different. But there's actually four different types of MS. The type I have is relapsing remitting MS. So the way I explain it is, so you start out at 100% and you have an attack. And so that'll take you down to like 80%. And then your body kind of restores itself. So you might get back up to 90%. So, but you're never back at that 100%. And, you know, you'll stay at that 90 for a while. And then you get an attack and it takes you down. And then you kind of get better, a little bit better. And then, so it's like a step, you know, like a staircase.
Yeah. What was your first clue that you had MS?
I was having issues with my balance. I was like walking into walls. I fell over in the shower. I would just tip over, and I talked to my doctor about it, and she sent me to a neurologist, and he sent me for MRIs, and MS was like the last thing on my mind. I had no idea. My mother's best friend has MS, so for me to be so close to someone who has it, I guess I just never suspected I would have it as well.
Thank you. Fortini, this obviously you work with this every day, and you work with a rather diverse population as the director for the Central Coast. There's an awful lot about this we don't understand. There's, I think for a lot of us, it's surprising that it manifests itself in so many different ways for people. I guess, what is the long-term prognosis for the average person who has MS, or is there an average person?
You know, it's a very good question, and there's not necessarily an average anymore. And the good news is that it is a different disease now than it was even 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when you'd get diagnosed, they'd send you home and wish you the best of luck. You know, now there are 13, almost 14 different treatments to help with relapsing remitting MS. There's another on the forefront for progressive MS for the first time, which is so exciting. It's come so far, so it's definitely a different disease now than it used to be, because now there is medicines to help slow down the progression of the disease, which is very exciting. And, you know, every day we're moving forward. I was diagnosed 9 years ago with MS, and to think when I first got diagnosed there were only 5 approved treatments for relapsing remitting MS, and now there's 13. To think in 9 years how far we've come, I am convinced that one day it will be a part of our past, and that's what we're working very hard for, to do that.
Okay. It's not hereditary, or it is hereditary, or can they trace origins looking at family history and things?
You know, that's one thing that they're still studying. That was kind of my first question. I want to start a family. Am I going to pass this on to my children if I start a family? And the answer is no. They can be genetically susceptible to it, but that's something that is definitely being studied in, you know, all throughout the world. You know, what is going on with genetics? They think that there is a genetic trigger. If you grow up near the equator, your chances of getting MS go down significantly. They don't know what that is. I'm from Colorado. For whatever reason, Colorado has one of the highest incidences in the United States, and so they don't know what's going on. They think there's environmental factors. They think there's a link to the Epstein-Barr virus. There's so many different factors, but they have not zeroed in on that. So, you know, there's no known cause and no known cure, but that's what they're working hard on every day.
You know, I brought up what I don't want to really look at as a traumatic case history, a dramatic case history, but the individual that I knew that had it, who I can't recall how fast it basically took over her, pretty much her whole nervous system. Mm-hmm. It started for her as kind of an inability to swallow clearly, and then it became an inability for her to speech without her voice feeling uncomfortable or kind of very hoarse. And it got very, very severe very quickly. And that was a surprise, because I'd known a number of people with MS, but no one had had a deteriorating condition. Most of the people I've known who have had MS, it slowed them down, but in some cases, but it certainly hasn't drastically disrupted their daily life in a lot of cases.
Correct. And that's something that can't be, unfortunately, it's something that cannot be, you know, even estimated. Everybody is so different, and every case is so different, and some people, their case is more progressive, but they don't know why, and they're really trying to zero in on exactly what's going on with those people. Why is their disease progressing even quicker and even more than others? You know, 3 out of 4 people with MS are women. Most men with MS, their disease is more aggressive. Why is it that the men's disease is more aggressive than the men, you know, than the women? So they're really trying to zero in on all of this, but there's so many different factors that go into it, and you know, there's not really one reason why someone's MS is more aggressive than the other, and it can affect anything that the central nervous, you know, controls, which is everything, unfortunately, from swallowing to vision to balance to walking to everything you can do.
Well, let me remind folks that this is a call-in program. We would like you to be part of the discussion. If you'd like to be part of the discussion, both questions and commentary, and maybe in some cases the commentary on your own life if you happen to be living with MS right now, the phone number is 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. We would really love for you to be part of the discussion. Let me get a little history information from you, Fortini. When was MS first even identified as a condition, and how was it first identified, and what's classified as MS and what's not classified as MS?
You know, it was identified as a condition, you know, several hundred years ago, I think, you know, then they were really starting to do this, but I think they really started identifying it when the MRI machines came out. You know, in the old days, they didn't know exactly what was going on with people who had multiple sclerosis, and when the MRI machines came out, then they were able to see the lesions on the brain, the spinal cord, the optic nerves, and so, you know, once they were able to do that and then able to identify, like April mentioned, the proteins on the spinal tap, then they were able to identify it more. So now I feel like more people are getting diagnosed more often and quicker, and the MRI machines are improving, and so they're able to identify them quicker. And so, you know, we've come so far just in identifying the cases of it because of that. So I would say... you know, it was identified several decades ago, but they didn't have a treatment to help slow down the progression of the disease then. You know, the first treatments didn't come out until 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
I think I read somewhere that it was like in the late 1800s, they identified something that they thought was MS, and they just basically would tell people to go to bed, like, you're done. And now we have... All these wonderful medications that slow down the progression, and it's really exciting. It's, if I had to have MS, at least now I'm at a time when they're making all sorts of leaps and bounds in research.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is it's not something that you're necessarily born with. It's something that develops in your mostly early 20s, I guess, early 20s to early 30s is when it seems to come up the most. Is that correct?
I was in my early 30s when I was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. Usually it's in your 30s or 40s that you're diagnosed. But you could have it for several years without realizing it. You know, you just feel tired and sick and don't know why. So... And, you know, I was going to the doctor for a few years before I was diagnosed, trying to figure out what the heck was wrong with me. I was feeling sick and in pain, and I didn't know why.
How long did it take before they were able to isolate exactly what it was as being MS?
I started at the time with my primary care physician. I think it was a good 3 years. But once I saw the neurologist, it was like 3 months. Like, that's it. the MRI, that was all it took. So,
do we, for both of you, do we have a medical community that, because they can't isolate it readily without, you know, I guess without ruling out a number of things, that you end up in a lot of cases with a population suffering from MS that maybe becomes the best source of information? They become proactive advocates for their own situation. My thought is, having to tell my doctor, hey, have you thought about whether I've got MS, because so far you've only told me about the 17 things it's not. So we become an advocate population for our own medical care, which is good, but sometimes that can be frustrating.
Absolutely, and that's where the MS Society has come in as well. We, of course, have so many resources for patients, but we also have so many resources for healthcare professionals as well. It's just as important to help raise awareness, not only in our communities for patients, but also for the healthcare professionals who, especially in the rural areas, who may not see, for whatever reason, not have access to this information. And so that's where we come in to get them this information so they are aware of it. So it helps with everything.
Yeah, in some of the notes that you shared with us before the program, so we could be prepared to obviously know what we were going to talk about today, you mentioned that there's an awful lot of people who confuse this with multiple muscular dystrophy, because obviously a similar name or similar letters used for it. I guess there's an awful lot of people who don't even know this disease exists. So I guess uphill battle for information.
It's a common mistake. It's definitely a common mistake when people are like, oh, Jerry's kids? And you're like, nope, that's MD. So just trying to, differentiate that and tell people, this MS is a disease of the central nervous system. MD is muscular dystrophy. And so, just educating people is so important. It helps build awareness.
Well, both of you have MS. I mean, that's not a deep, dark secret. We've talked about it so far on the program. Do you feel, either of you feel like the condition is, in your treatment, has made things better? Is over time it making things worse? Not the treatment, but just time. And how do you look at that on a daily basis?
Sure. I can go first on this
go
one.
Ahead.
So I've had MS for 9 years, and when I got started, I was on different treatments because my disease was so aggressive, especially at the beginning. Those treatments weren't helping at all. My disease kept progressing even more. My MRIs came back with more lesions and damage in my brain and spinal cord and optic nerves. And, being your own best advocate and with your doctors and saying, this is not working for me, I finally got onto a new treatment. The good news is that 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they did send you home and wish you the best of luck. Now we do have 13 different treatments. So if one didn't work, I moved to the next. And that one didn't work, so I moved to the next. And so now I finally do have a treatment that has slowed down the progression of my disease significantly, where my MRIs have come back with no new lesions. And, when there's no new damage, then it's doing its job. Obviously, the damage that's been done has been done, and you deal with those challenges. But it's very encouraging to know that it has done something.
People, jump in. Go ahead.
And I feel like the medication has really helped me. Like, it's plateaued. When I first was diagnosed, with the MRI, they was it like a year later, they did another one. And I had one new lesion, but since then, no new lesions. I've been very lucky, and I do believe it's that I've been on the right medication, so it helps. When I was diagnosed, they gave me a packet of like six different information packets of medication, and they send you home with it, and you have to do your homework and choose which one you think is best, because the neurologist wants you to, pick it. So
April, start with you. How you feel, is it reasonably consistent when your medication is doing what it's supposed to do? There aren't good days and there aren't bad days. It's just every day and you know what your plateau of comfort is?
No, I mean, honestly, for me, I never know. I never know from day to day. I never know, like, I could wake up and feel like $1 million and I'm going to go run a marathon. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I just all of a sudden just, nope, actually I'm going to go to bed because my body is just not, you know. And other days I wake up and I'm like, I'm not even going to make it out of bed, or I'll, you know, make it to the couch. But, you know, it just kind of, it varies from day to day. And I just try to take advantage of the good days and do the most that I can. And yeah.
Yeah. Fortini, how did you get involved from being, if you will, being a patient with MS to being someone who's, your daily career is related to working in the education and betterment for the life of people who have MS in our society. So how did that evolve for you?
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's funny. It kind of became a blessing in disguise. I used to work. I was a broadcast journalism student in Central California, and I was in my senior year of college when I got diagnosed. And so, you know, I started volunteering for the MS Society and realized, wow, I would just love to work for them. This is amazing, and I'd love to give back to the MS community and be there, especially for everybody, but especially the newly diagnosed, to know that, you know, there is life after diagnosis. And so I got very involved with the special events in Central California, and so one thing led to the next, and I've worked for them for almost 7.5 years, and it's been a very, very fulfilling job. You know, I care about it and have a vested interest, to say the least. You know, it's, when you care about something, it's not hard to ask people for money, for donations, when it's something that you really care deeply about. Hmm. So that's how I got involved.
Yeah. I want to remind folks that this is a program that we're talking about MS and how it manifests for people, and just some information about it and what it's like living with MS. Both of my guests currently have MS. You're welcome to be part of the discussion. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 781-3875. If you have MS or have a family member that has MS and you have some thoughts or observations you'd like to share with us, that would be great to be part of the discussion, or just if you have questions. Okay, let's, if we can, I don't want to hold either of you to a lot of science, but help me out here. There's damage to the central nervous system, and is it the myelin? Is that what it is?
Correct. Okay. It's the myelin sheath that protects the nerves. It's kind of like an electrical cord that's covered with rubber. You know, when that rubber is damaged, then the messaging from one end of the electrical cord to the other is going to get interrupted, and it's going to slow it down for the messaging. The same thing.
The example I always give is my cat really likes to chew on cords. And I can't tell you how many phone charging cords we've gone through, but he chews on it a little bit.
So blame MS on the cat, okay.
Yeah, no. No, but okay. If he chews on the cord a little bit, the phone will still charge, but it just charges a little bit slower. Like, it's kind of the same way, like the message in your brain will still get through. It just takes a little more time. But eventually the cat chews all the way through the cord, and unfortunately, I can't buy new brain cells, but I can buy new phone charging cords.
So most of the medications that you can take for this are related to slowing down the process?
Yes.
Okay. So if you could get your cat to chew slower, the shielding on the cord would last longer.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I think of it as like I give my – it's a daily shot, and I think of it as like – giving my immune system something else to attack. So I guess it's like having a cat toy. Give my cat something else to pay attention to. I mean, for using that analogy.
A diversionary tactic. That makes sense. Okay. Okay.
I don't know how science-y that is.
No, I think that's a very it's a very good, reasonable explanation for the situation. Fortini, what is your What is your explanation, I guess? Can you top that for amusing?
I'm sorry.
I don't know if I can top that one. I do always say it's just like an electrical cord. I like how she uses that analogy. I think it's just the best way to do that, to show, you know, what your nerves have myelin sheath protecting it. And so obviously if the myelin sheath is damaged, then that messaging getting through, just to do something simple to move, move anything, everything that the central nervous system controls, you know, if that damage is there and the messaging isn't getting through or it's slowing it down, because of that damage, that can be an issue. You know, neurology is amazing too, because sometimes we can rework, and neurologically we can rework needing to do something and kind of rebuild that, but it doesn't always happen that way. So, you know, everybody's case is different, unfortunately, and so we try to rehab out of certain attacks and stuff like that, but some people have more luck than others.
Okay. Well, we do have a caller. It's kind of a surprise here. Hold on a second. Beth, are you there?
I sure am.
Okay, and I want to double-check. Fertini, can you hear Beth?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Beth is calling from Chicago, which is nice to know that we have people listening to us on the World Wide Web. But April has also made it reasonably clear that this is probably a relative of hers.
My auntie. Okay. Hi, auntie.
Okay. Hi, Beth, what do you want to add to the discussion? Jump on in here. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to bring up if they can discuss a little bit more on all the different things that MS affects, from speech to trying to find words when they're talking, to support from home and all the other networks of support out there, extended family, friends, etc. How far does the MS patient reach out for help, and not to be afraid to ask for help?
Okay. Well, Beth, I'll start with this for you, but before I let them answer, and that is that since April did not crawl under the table the minute she saw that it was Beth from Chicago, I believe she feels she has good family support.
Very much so.
She does.
Okay.
She does.
Anyway. For Tini.
You know, it's more for your listener that they understand how important family, friends, and external help is to the person that has MS.
Thank you. That's a very good point. If I disconnect the call, can you continue to listen on your internet connection then?
Yes.
Okay. All righty. Thank you very much for calling. And that's a very good point. Fortini, I guess that brings up a key factor. I mean, people count on family and friends for support in a lot of areas. There's also a lot of people who feel about a lot of things. Oh, you know, if you have some illness, I want to stay away from you. If there's something going on with you, it makes me uncomfortable too. But community support, and we're going to talk more about that with some of the things that you're doing in the community, are big factors. But is there a good family network of support that goes with the MS organizations?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the National MS Society, we, of course, provide so many educational programs, not only for the MS patients, but also for their families. And then, of course, we also have a ton of support groups for people with MS, but also for the caregivers. You know, it's just as important. You know, it's not just the person who's going through MS that's going through all of the challenges, but also everybody that's around them. And so the support makes all of the difference, and so on both ends. And so that's where the MS Society comes in. We have so many resources and so much support on our end to help with that.
Yeah. Some statistics that you shared with me, I want to remind folks about. There are approximately 500 people in San Luis Obispo County that are diagnosed with MS. There's about 650 people in Santa Barbara County diagnosed with MS. And there's a little over 300 people in Monterey County diagnosed with MS. And as I read those numbers, it occurred to me, how many people do you or medical professionals believe have maybe early stages of MS and don't know it yet, or have things going on in their life that they never attribute to MS? They just think it's because they're getting older, or they're or they're uncoordinated, or any number of rationalizations I can make for why things may not be as good as I want them to be. Are there a lot of population that it's undiagnosed?
You know, it probably yes. And those numbers that you have are just numbers of people that have identified with us, with the National MS Society, you know, so there's got to be so many other people that have never contacted us that we don't necessarily know exist. And so, they say there's millions of people throughout the world that have MS. They used to say 400,000, but I know that that number is so low now with all of the diagnosis. And so that's why raising awareness is so important. And with people, just to reach out to the MS Society so that we know that they exist. And they might not need a resource at the moment, but there's so many other things that we offer with resources, with positive things of just moving forward and events and just things to make it a part of our past to help raise awareness and do what we can on our end.
Yeah. I want to go back to a point that you both talked about a little earlier, and that was that there's about a 2-to-1 ratio or a 2-to-3 ratio, if you will, between men who are diagnosed with it and women are diagnosed with it. More women are diagnosed with it. Is there been any kind of research to look at what that is? Because there may be some clues to what the origin of it is. And I hate to say it, but I guess as the male in this discussion, I confess up to it. Men tend to believe they're more invincible and don't go to the doctor as often. So there may be a lot more men who have MS that are just saying, oh, it's just arthritis, or it's just because I'm getting a little older. And those can be factors that come into play. Has any of the research looked at that disparity in gender?
Absolutely. I mean, I think those are very good points that you've raised. That, you know, is there a reason why people just aren't being identified? But they are looking into, you know, of course, genetics on what's going on, but also gender and why that's happening. You know, with women, for whatever reason, most women with MS, when they get pregnant, go into remission, and they don't know what causes that. They think they've zeroed in on a hormone that affects that. And so that's being studied at UCLA right now. And the Southern California and Nevada chapter of the National MS Society is funding that. They think they've zeroed in on the hormone that helps with this effect. Of course, it's in phase two right now. None of the pharmaceutical companies are, you know, supporting this because it's out of patent. And so the MS Society, a lot of the money we raise goes to research, but that's a research project that the Southern California and Nevada chapter is working on. You know, why is it that women, when they get pregnant, go into remission? You know, there's got to be something, a link there, too. And so there's a ton of research looking into that. So we'll see. I think that they're going to start identifying more of that in the future, especially with gender.
Hardy, I want to remind folks, this is Central Coast Voices, and we're talking today about a very interesting topic and a very serious topic, and that's multiple sclerosis, and talking with two people who have it, and both and one who actually works for the MS Society to deal with a lot of those issues. I want to remind you that there are some events coming up. Fortini, I'll let you jump in here. There's a walk. There's two walks. One walk in San Luis Obispo County, one in Monterey County, and one in Santa Barbara County. Why don't you give us a little bit of history as to what those events are and how people can get involved in them?
Of course. Yeah, the Walk MS events are really fantastic events. One, it's just really a great event. My favorite part about the walk is that you go to them and you realize, wow, I'm not alone. Look how many people in our communities this affects. And so we have a walk in San Luis Obispo on April 9th, this week and this Saturday, which we're so excited about, in San Luis Obispo. It's in Symer Park. And then on April 24th, we'll have one in Monterey Bay at Pacific Grove, which we're excited about that. And then April 30th, one in Santa Barbara. So, like I said, it's really a great place for the communities to really come together. You know, there's not a minimum that has to be raised to participate in it, but it is a fundraiser, and, you know, money that's raised at these events does support research, and obviously we need a lot of it, but it's come so far, but also programs and services to help with people with MS and their families, because it is something that affects the entire family.
Yeah. As you're talking about that, obviously what we're talking about and what you're talking about with events like the Walk MS is a way to get the community more involved. I'm wondering, do you have many people who, for whatever reason, this is an embarrassment or they want to keep it secret? I mean, do we have a lot of people who have MS that are, it's like, oh, don't tell my family this, or don't tell my coworkers? And do you run into that? April, why don't we give me some idea? Does that come up for you very much?
Well, I think it's everyone's own decision how they want to reveal to people they have it or if they do. I made the decision to tell my friends and family as soon as I knew, because the 3 months of my diagnosis, it was like all I was dealing with and all I could think about and do. And it was just, I guess I just wanted to kind of get it all out at once and be done with it. But I think it's an individual decision. And I think that, I'm sorry. I don't want to get too like political, but I think someone who is working might be nervous about telling their employer, I have MS. That would be kind of, I don't know. Sorry.
I think that's a realistic issue, and that's something that probably comes up. And for Tina, you may have more experience with that, dealing with a broader population in your work. Are there people
Absolutely.
Who get ostracized and or deal with negative repercussions for coming out and telling people this is what I'm working with and please either help me or support me? And in some cases that may mean for some people, or we're going to just ignore you because it's too uncomfortable for us to think about.
I think it's a fear. I think more than anything, it's a fear. I think people don't want to be, taken as being weak, especially in the workplace. It's kind of ironic, a few years ago I was having vision issues and I work for the National MS Society and I was afraid to call my employer, to say I have vision issues. Not that they wouldn't be so supportive, but we don't want to be thought of as I can't do the job. And so I think more times than not, people probably don't come out of saying that they are dealing with this for that reason. People don't want to be thought of as not being able to do their job or not being able to live their life. And so, it's interesting. More times than not, I think people do not come out to say that they are dealing with MS. And every situation is different. But people don't realize that they're protected by the law and they can't be discriminated against. But, of course, everyone has that fear, unfortunately. And so, we do what we can to show that the MS Society is here to support everybody, to support workplace, support everything. So, but it is a common problem. Not even a problem, but a common thing that happens.
Yeah, we tend to have an unfortunately more prejudicial society than we'd like to have for a lot of mm-hmm. us. And we also have some very open, supportive people who pretty much unconditionally love and support us. If we're positive about what's going on in our life, so I'm sure you see both of it. Fortini, I don't know your whole history, so I'm curious. Did you work for the MS Society before you were diagnosed, or did you come to the society because it was something you gravitated to for the support you wanted?
So I came to the society after I was diagnosed with MS. I had an educational program with my. Well, he was my boyfriend at the time, just to learn more about it. And because I had no idea what was going on. Nobody in my family ever had MS. We my family members were the people that said, oh, Jerry's kids, that they were doing the MD, Confusion Act.
Yeah.
And so, I think that it was for the educational program that I was really turned on to the resources that the MS Society had and to the programs and services, but also all of the positive events on raising money for research, just to bring it a part of our past. I think that it's so awesome. And so that's how I got turned on to the MS Society. So I left, I was working in TV at the time, and I left the TV industry and decided that I wanted to volunteer for the MS Society, and it turned into a part-time job and then a full-time job. And so that's how I came to the MS Society.
Well, it's we gravitate towards things that that have support and help motivate us to address things in our life. So that's a wonderful way in which to move into that kind of position. And I thank you for sharing that with us. If someone thinks they have symptoms that that may be related to MS, what is the first thing they should do, other than maybe just contact their primary care physician? I've said that before on programs, and people have reminded me that there's an awful lot of people who don't have a primary care physician, even though we all should have one. What's the first step for someone who thinks they may have some symptoms of MS?
Well, I think the first symptom would be you need to see a doctor, because, you know, they need to work out everything that's going on. You know, all of the symptoms, just because you have any of the symptoms with numbness and tingling and vision issues, you know, coordination issues, you know, just because you have any of those symptoms doesn't necessarily mean that you have MS. And so they really need to work out to see what's going on, and they should refer you to a neurologist, somebody that specializes in neurology, and ideally to see an MS specialist, because they really know the disease more than anything. And so it's important to be seen by a doctor, just so they can start, you know, cutting out what it's not and what's going on.
April, were you able to find someone who could work with you directly on your MS symptoms in San Luis County, or did you have to go to a larger medical facility to get the help you needed?
Well, I was referred to a neurologist, and he diagnosed me, and then he suggested that my husband and I go down to USC and see an MS specialist down there, just to kind of get a second opinion, and because while the neurologist will be the one to treat you, they don't specialize in it, you know, so we did, we went down to LA and saw the MS specialist, and my neurologist is the one who kind of coordinates my medication and treatment and all of that.
And from what you've both said, 20 or 25 years ago, a lot of the treatments that you have now were not available. So did they, in your case, April, did they have to try a lot of different treatments to figure out what was going to work? Or did they have a pretty good idea right away what would work for you?
Well, like I said, my doctor gave me six pamphlets, you know, six booklets, each from a different medication, and said, go home and study these, and you know, we'll talk about it at your next appointment, what you want to take. And so I think I just got lucky in that the first medication I picked seems to be good for me. So
very good.
Yeah.
Fortini, how about you? Was there a lot of trial and error to get you into a place where your treatment was working?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because my diagnosis didn't take long. My diagnosis was so out of a textbook diagnosis. Everything that they say happens in MS was happening with me, but it did take a few treatments to finally find the treatment that works best for me. And so I think that's why it's so important for people to be their own best advocate, to really, you know, educate themselves and really make sure that their doctors are educated too, that there's more options out there besides the one they might be used to. And so, I took a few trials for me to find one, but then I finally did find one. And so, it's nice to know that I was able to move to the next, you know, even 20 years ago when they only maybe had one treatment, that was your only option. So if that wasn't working, then there really wasn't anything else you could do. So the fact that we now have, at least for relapsing remitting MS, 13 different options is really exciting.
Okay. For both of you, I'll throw this out there. Are there any things about your diet or lifestyle that you needed to specifically adjust to help your treatment? I mean, to lower my cholesterol, there are certain things I shouldn't be eating, and in most cases I don't eat them unless my cardiologist is listening, in which case I never eat them, honest. but those kind of things come up. I mean, what are there dietary things? Are there forms of exercise that are more helpful for either of you that help address some of your symptoms? April, go ahead.
Well, just I try to stay as active as possible. I also try to I do like little like puzzle games and things like that to try to keep my mind active as well. And you know, just I kind of have the like use it or lose it philosophy. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Fortini, are there things that the medical science has said, okay, you're going to slow down this process if you don't eat carrots? Probably a silly example,
now,
but
yeah, yes. It's a very good question. No, now I think more than ever they are looking into diet. Really never was paid attention to, and now I think overall wellness is being paid attention to, and so I think that they really are trying to zero in on certain diets. They may help people with MS, and I think that people with MS, we should be on the same diet that everybody should be on. You know, it's there are certain things that we all should and shouldn't eat. And so I think figuring out what works best for you and your own diet, but overall wellness, I think with exercise, just keeping the movement going, whatever you're able to do. Some people are not able to necessarily walk far or walk at all, but just any movement that we can do I think is so important for overall wellness with MS. And so I think that with a healthy diet, I think it all goes hand in hand.
Yeah. I know a musician down in Ventura who has MS, and she has told me that she thought she wasn't going to be able to do as much music as her MS progressed. And her observation most recently when I've talked to her, which is quite some time ago, but was that the amount of work she does, she's a guitarist and writes, she's a singer-songwriter, that what she does with her music actually has helped her a lot keep her mobility up. You know, it's not like she's out running and jogging to keep her mobility up. She may be doing that anyway, but she says her hand-eye coordination and playing guitar was very, very helpful for her to both help slow her MS down and also to keep her aware of what was going on. So I think that those kind of things may work for a lot of MS sufferers too. But
absolutely. And in finding what it is with each individual person that would give them that kind of that peace, you know, that balance with everything that they do, I think is so important.
Yeah, it's very good. Let's remind folks that there's an upcoming walk in San Luis Obispo on April 9th. And there's a Walk MS in San Luis Obispo on the 9th, Walk MS in Monterey on the 24th, and Walk MS in Santa Barbara on the 30th. How can they contact your organization to get more information about that?
Yeah, so they could go to walkms.org, www.walkms.org, and they'd be able to pull up the closest Walk MS
area,
yeah. Which is very exciting.
That's great to find them. So just walkms.org, and they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we have one
Absolutely.
More phone. We've got a couple of minutes, but we've got one more phone call I want to go. Nicole, are you there?
I am.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes. Jump on in here.
Sure. So my mom was diagnosed with MS back when she was 32. She's now 56. She's on daily medication. She gives herself a shot every day. And so it's always in the back of my mind. There's not a lot of research on whether or not the disease is hereditary, but we do have other members of the family who were diagnosed with MS several years ago. But my question is, you talked a little bit about diet and overall wellness and things that you can do in order to kind of mitigate the symptoms of the disease. And I've heard a lot about vitamin D deficiencies and how that, they think, plays a huge role in multiple sclerosis diagnosis in a lot of the symptoms. So I was wondering if somebody, if you guys, if either of you ladies have anything to say about that, if it's something you've heard from your doctor, do you take vitamin D supplements?
Sure. That's a very good question. And yes, most MS patients do have a vitamin D deficiency. I know I did.
I do.
And so that it's something to work with your doctors on making sure that you are taking vitamin D. I do take vitamin D vitamins, and I think most MS patients who I've spoken with, when they work with their doctors and it's been tested and they realize they do have a vitamin D deficiency, also get on vitamins as well.
Yeah, I take vitamin D as well.
Okay. How was? Thanks very much for the call, Nicole. That brings up a very good point. I appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
How was that discovered? I mean, that's interesting that, oh, there's a vitamin D deficiency here. Any idea?
I think through all the research that's happened, you know, when they're trying to zero in exactly what is going on, what are the similarities with all of the MS patients, and they're realizing vitamin D deficiency is one of them. And so there is a huge link to that, and so they're trying to figure that out, which they think there's a link to that with the Epstein-Barr virus, and there's a link with Epstein-Barr and MS. You know, there's so many different factors that are going into it, and so I think they just realized that almost all MS patients, for whatever reason, are vitamin D deficient.
Beyond the walks that you do and the organization's support of research and medical treatment, are there support groups or discussion groups for both family and for patients that can get together? April, are you a member of a group like that? Or
I am. I go to the support group that meets in Arroyo Grande. It's the second Tuesday of every month from 6 to 8 o'clock, and they hold it at the United Methodist Church, which is 275 Halcyon, or Halcyon.
Halcyon, yeah.
Yeah. And but they meet once a month, and it's a group of really wonderful people, and they all get together and share experiences, and it's good to know that you're not alone.
Yeah. That's good for anything that you have to work with that's not what we would consider routine.
And, yeah. Yeah.
Fortini, if people go to the walkms.org site, does it also get them in touch with your organization? So if they want to hear about support groups or get involved with something like that, it's available to them?
Sure. Actually, even quicker way for them would be the nationalmssociety.org website. And so not that you couldn't probably hyperlink from walkms.org over to that site, but if they go to nationalmssociety.org, they'll find so much information. There's so many resources on there. Of course, they'll find their local chapters, local offices. They can get them connected with local support groups, local programs and services. We have so many wellness programs throughout the Central Coast, you know, to help with every issue that happens with MS.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's a lot of things out there that people don't know about, and it's amazing what you can find when you Google it. So I think that's a very, very good way to proceed with that. We've got a couple of minutes left. I want to give you each an opportunity to kind of, as I often do, give you a couple of minutes at the end of the program to share what's most important for you to make sure that the people who are sharing the program with us today know about MS. And April, I'll start with you.
Well, I just think it's really, really important that research continue. The more research, the better. Just the great amount of progress they've made in such a short time gives me hope that there will one day be a cure. If you do have MS, having a good support group, a good support system is important. I am very lucky. I have a wonderful husband who is extremely supportive. I have a family that's extremely supportive. His family, my husband's family, is extremely supportive. I have friends from even across the country.
Yeah, you have an
family.
Aunt Beth in Chicago. Yes.
I'm very lucky, and I think that has really helped me. So I want to say thank you to all of them as well. But just raising awareness of MS. There's still people that don't know what MS is, and that, you know, hopefully one day that will not be a reality.
That's a very good point. Are there people who have shied away from you because of MS?
Yeah. Yeah. When I got my diagnosis, I did lose a few friends, but the ones I kept, man, they're amazing. And, you know, if the way I looked at it is I only have a certain amount of energy to spend anyway, so I'd rather spend it on the people that are important. So that's
a very, very good point. Yeah. It's our selection process of friends needs refinement sometimes anyway. Yeah. Anyway, Fortini, you probably have a lot to share that you want to make sure people don't forget. So jump on in here.
Yeah, no, I have to get to go along with April. Is the importance of raising MS awareness is so important, but also knowing that the MS Society is such an amazing resource. We have so many programs and services and just so much information to help educate people. Our National MS Society website, nationalmssociety.org, has amazing information, which is so great. If you just want to learn about more about the disease, that's what's so important. And I think what's also so important, for especially for the newly diagnosed, is that there is life after diagnosis now, where, you know, 25 years ago they did send you home and wish you the best of luck, and your disease, when it wasn't being treated, was getting more progressive. And so I think what's exciting is that we've come so far, and I, too, am so convinced that MS is going to be a part of our past, and I do believe it'll happen in my lifetime, maybe towards the end of my lifetime, but I think that we've come so far already. I, you know, they call it the polio of the 90s. I hope that one day I have to explain to my children and grandchildren what MS was, because I'll be like, oh, that was a long time ago, you know, so I hope that we're at that point one day. But we do have a lot of resources, and I hope if you're in any of the areas where we're having the MS walks, please come out and support them. It's a great community event, and we'd love to see you out there.
I want to jump in with the fact that I think that even if people may be a little reluctant to participate in the walk, or they feel it's a fundraiser that's not, you know, where they want to put their energy, it's a good information source. So if people want to just come out for some initial information about things regarding MS, there'll be information available for them at the walks, I hope.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's going to be an MS info booth at every single one of those, and so there's a ton of great information with what we do and what we do for everybody.
Okay. I thank you very much. It's been a great program, I want to remind people that if there's any part of this program or the information that you didn't catch about some of the walks, it is available on the KCBX website. It's usually up and available for you to either download or listen to the entire program by the next morning after the program. So if you go to kcbx.org, you can get a hold of the program there too. I want to thank my guests, Fortini Alferes and April Nordyke, for being with us today. It's been a wonderful program. Thank you for sharing your personal stories. Sometimes I'm sure that's either frustrating or risky to do, and especially on the radio, so I thank you for being willing to do that. I want to remind people that this has been Central Coast Voices, and we're a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Even though Pledge Drive is starting tomorrow for KCBX, and we hope you will participate in that if you're not already a subscriber, Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week, and she'll be talking with the director and producer of the documentary film East LA Interchange. That's Betsy Kalin, and the associate producer Ruby Gomez, and they will be joined with Floyd Jeter Jr., who is a featured individual in the program who happens to be a local resident of San Luis Obispo County. East LA Interchange is a documentary about the Boyle Heights community coming together as a Mexican-American community to face challenges that were related at the time to a freeway going through the middle of their community, but it became a lot more, and she'll talk about that program with her guests next week on the program. Central Coast Voices, as I said before, is a project of Action for Healthy Communities. We thank the underwriting of Joan Gillard Sargent for the program. You can reach Central Coast Voices at kcbx.org or 543-2323. Thank you for joining us today.
us.
Oh.
Are you still there? Hello. No, she might have hung up. Or I don't have her. See if you've got her on your phone. Hi there. We neglected to tell you that there'd be about 45 seconds of dead silence before we could put you back on to talk with you for a couple of minutes. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. It's okay. I was sitting there. I'm like, I guess I hang up, and so I'm sorry. I didn't know.
No, that's okay. It was my fault for not telling you that. That's okay. Thank you very much. That was a terrific program. I hope you both got some good exposure for your organization and